I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In more than 100 years of filmmaking, the summer of 1982 stands out. The futuristic Blade Runner, the romantic An Officer and a Gentleman, the terrifying Poltergeist all opened that season. Throw in the comedy of Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid and the science fiction of E.T., and you have the beginnings of the summer blockbuster season. Today, our video gurus return to explain why May through August of 82 set the scene for what's become a yearly tradition of mega movies. Was it the sheer number of films released, the variety, the Hollywood names? We'll find out on Up to Date after this hour's news. It's summer. That means blockbuster season. In fact, it was the summer of 1982, a mere 35 years ago, that began to define the idea and formula of the summer blockbuster season. It was also arguably the golden year of summer genre films. E.T., The Thing, Rocky III, Star Trek II, Blade Runner, Tron, Poltergeist, An Officer and a Gentleman, Night Shift, and so many more. There were also some notable misfires like Firefox and Megaforce. Today, the DVD gurus have reunited in our studio to talk about the big, big year of 1982. The gurus are UMKC film professor and screenwriter Mitch Bryan. Mitch, good to have you.
It's great to be back.
Jason Heck has moved out to the country since his latest appearance here, but remains an encyclopedia of cinematic knowledge. Welcome back.
A bumper crop of terrific summer movies.
Erin Hammerbeck is also here. She teaches at the Kansas City Art Institute and UMKC. She's a screenwriter. Her script, Jukebox Baby and the Luxury Bombshells, just won Best Heartland Screenplay and Audience Choice Award in the Kansas City Women in Film and TV Short Screenplay Contest. And Erin, welcome. Nice to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm curious. Give us the thumbnail sketch of what Jukebox Baby and the Luxury Bombshells is all about.
Well, it's a short film, and it's basically about these luxury bombshells. They're kind of Stepford Wives types, and they come together. They have a tea party, and it's somewhat ruined when this mysterious woman called Jukebox Baby shows up, and she's a space pirate, and she starts destroying all of these pirate zombies that descend upon the Crystal Palace of the luxury bombshells. There's a little twist in the end, but it's a crazy, fun script.
Sounds like an 80s movie.
Yeah.
Ho-hum, haven't we seen this before?
I know. I know, so cliched.
Okay, Mitch, it sounds like 1982 was quite a year.
It really was. It was, to that point, the largest number of sequels in any season. There were 10 sequels that year. Now, that would intensify, and by 1988, we would have 20 sequels. But there's gold in them, there are hills, and they realized the studios, as the corporations began to buy the studios up, they were in the business of making big, big, big money. The filmmakers who had been deconstructing genres all through the 70s, people like Spielberg and Lucas and De Palma and Coppola, now were embracing genre, embracing classical styles, and basically the B movie got the A budget. And they realized that summer was the time for big escapist movies.
Yeah, you know, the list of films from that year is, it just jaw-dropping, just an amazing list.
Yeah, and such a wide variety, even though we'll be talking about summer movies, which did tend to be genre fair, and that's where that formula starts to happen. There were very few dramas during the summer, but there were extraordinary dramas the rest of the year round, and just a wide range of pictures for lots of different audiences. So things were starting to change, though. They were beginning to look for that super formula of the blockbuster that would hit all age ranges, that would be spread over marketing through music and product placement, recognizable titles, all that stuff that would ultimately, I think, kind of climax with 1989's Batman, which was sort of this gigantic blockbuster hit that kind of took all of the information that had been learned through the 80s and turned it into this package that nobody could stop.
So, Jason, just to clarify, the summer blockbuster season really didn't exist as we know it today until 1982 came along. Do I have that right?
Well, you had movies that started it. You could say that certainly Jaws was the obvious one. You know, mm-hmm. you have a movie that opened in summer and that sort of started studios along this path of putting a lot of their eggs in the summer basket. As Mitch said, they were owned by corporations at this point. Gulf, Western, you know, these giant conglomerates that just looked at a studio as just a movie-making arm, not necessarily out there to make art. And so they became more formulaic, more robotic. But 82, you had these sort of these movies that married formula with a lot of really great talent that yielded classic genre films. Star Trek II is pretty much unimpeachably the greatest Star Trek of all time.
And
it deals with huge issues, some really mm-hmm. great ones. And Nicholas Meyer said, you know, the first one was a little too disco-y and it dealt with some stuff that was a little too big and silly. And I'm going to go back and find this story about kind of one guy and mortality. And it's great. It's amazing. Rocky III. It's like the best Rocky movie. It's really, really, really good.
Remind us which one that was.
Well, we're going to talk about it, okay, but it's Rocky. Right. It's Rocky taking on Clubber Lang, Mr. T.
Oh, that's right.
And
that's
it's yeah. really good. It's this meat and potatoes filmmaking, and the Rocky movie, and, you know, Rocky IV, and I think we all remember 1985 where he takes on 6'7" Ivan Drago, this huge Russian, and it's Cold War, and there he's fighting a Superman. But Rocky III is really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
Airplane 2, God bless it. You know, if Airplane never existed, Airplane 2 would be really funny. Unfortunately, it's held up against this a comedy titan, and it's written and directed by the guy behind Grease 2, Mr. Ken Finkelman.
And Airplane Big summer 2 is, for Ken.
And Ken really put it out there. Yeah. And Ken got his start with Rick Moranis.
We'll talk about these different films today, but do you all have a favorite from 1982, that one film that really stands out for you, Aaron? Is there one there?
I mean, I love E.T. I grew up watching E.T. I had an E.T. sweater. I had an E.T. doll. I had all of the memorabilia.
Did you eat Reese's Pieces?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah. Just because E.T. ate them. But, you know, obviously, I love Star Trek too. Wrath of Khan is so iconic. And, you know, it's one of those movies that I can just keep going back to. And I'm still amazed. It doesn't look like it's a 1982 film. It looks brand new.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you know, it's incredible. And E.T. to a certain extent. I just rewatched that one recently and it holds up really well. So,
what's your favorite film of 1982, Mitch?
Probably The Thing, but we talk about it so often on this show, I decided not to talk about that today.
Oh.
But I still love The Thing very, very much.
The Thing, which was about?
Which was the John Carpenter movie about a group of Arctic researchers who are invaded by this shape-shifting creature, and you don't know who's who and who's the monster and who's not.
Jason, how about you?
Call it a three-way between Blade Runner, The Thing, and Star Trek II. I mean, yeah. Admittedly, they're all sci-fi slash genre movies, but they're all so expertly crafted in such paragons of the genre that honestly each one is a film school unto themselves for how to do that particular type of movie, and all of them are countlessly relentlessly imitated to this day. You know, these are progenitors, so it's hard not to look at Star Trek II and think about how much space operas have evolved from there and how brilliant it is to take a sci-fi staple like that and kind of bring it down to earth when it's in its use of metaphor, as opposed to the first one, which was just, you know, with Orson Welles on the trailer and so huge and so gigantic and so too hard to relate to. And Star Trek II is not hard to relate to. It's effortless.
See, it's so good to have him back, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
So good to have him back.
I've lost a few crops to an early frost, but, you know, I'll get back out there.
You'll get there. If our listeners can recall or can tie a favorite movie from back in the day to 1982, and want to give us a call and talk about it, 816-235-2888 is our number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Okay, let's go to our list of films we're going to talk about here. And Mitch, you want to begin with a scary one. It was called Poltergeist.
And this was the summer of Steven Spielberg, because he produced and co-wrote this movie. Some say he secretly directed it behind the scenes. That at least there was a very close collaboration with director Tobe Hooper. Spielberg was forbidden from directing anything else because he was preparing and in the process of finishing E.T. Mm-hmm. So this summer, both of those movies opened during the same month, which is kind of crazy. He was almost competing with himself. They opened only a week apart from each other.
Huh.
And it has that Spielberg feel. The storyboarding of the movie makes it, whether Hooper did it or Spielberg did it, there's lots of dollies into people looking up off camera and wonder on their faces. I mean, it just looks and smells like a Spielberg movie, but it's a really scary one. It still holds up. It's still full of surprises. It's shocking. It's a really amazing movie. And also as an 80s touchstone, it's very interesting because you've got these two the Freeling family who lives out in this big sprawling suburban paradise called Cuesta Verde. And the mom and dad are baby boomers who clearly were hippies. She's smoking dope in one scene while he's reading the new Reagan biography. So things have changed. They've moved, wow, evolved into the 80s. They have three kids. They're putting in a new swimming pool. They're living the perfect suburban life. And then something terrible starts to happen, which ultimately their little girl, Carol Ann, winds up being sucked into the television and catapulted off to some other dimension, and they have to bring in a bunch of ghost hunters to try to clear the house, and all sorts of secrets get dredged up in the process. It's a really exciting movie. It still holds up. It still has so much charm to burn. It's just really wonderful, and yet it's still scary. And yeah, in fact, it got slapped with an R rating, and Spielberg and Hooper kind of went in and lobbied for a PG. Eventually, this would be sort of one of those things that would evolve into the PG-13 rating because, mm-hmm, again, Spielberg would produce Gremlins and would direct Indiana Jones 2, and those would get slapped with R's, and so they would have to create a whole new rating that would allow them to push further than PG-13 but not quite be R. And that happened because you've got the most powerful filmmakers in Hollywood saying to the ratings board, you got to help us here, and you've got the big corporations saying you've got to help them here because there's money to be made.
Yeah.
So it's a really interesting period just in terms of like how the corporate forces are being marshaled by these filmmakers. And eventually that will flip. By the time you get to the end of this decade, the filmmakers will be at the mercy of those corporate powers. But at this point, the corporations are still trusting the filmmakers to go out and make these movies. And here comes Spielberg, hot off of Raiders of the Lost Ark, and delivers these two blockbusters, bang, bang, right after each other. Wow. And it really dominated the whole summer.
I'm really struck by a couple of you have already said here today that these films, as they came out in 1982, but they hold up really, really well today. And people can go get these and enjoy them as much as they did back then, it sounds
if
like.
If you want a great example, look at how many of these are routinely screened by the Alamo Drafthouse on Main Street. They know exactly what their audience wants to see. And it's not just 40-year-olds who go and see them, who grew up with them or saw them on, you know, VHS or HBO. It's millennials who are going to see this stuff. Huh. And Poltergeist holds up incredibly well. I mean, the fact that you had a lot of money to, you know, to throw at special effects, they age pretty well compared to a lot of the special effects. The ILM stuff in Wrath of Khan is phenomenal and beautiful and poetic and amazing. Poltergeist is the same way. It holds up. But you also just have experts making it. And it's the Freeling family. You want them to be your neighbors. You want the Freelings to be your parents. They're great. They're funny. They're sarcastic. They're clearly in love. Their kids are well-adjusted and funny. And I mean, it's a great movie.
You know, Aaron, how much did this film scare you when you saw it back in the day?
You know, I wasn't allowed to watch it back in the day.
I was gonna say,
But when I did finally watch it, I was probably in my early 20s, and it was authentically terrifying. I mean, you know, that there's something calming about the mother's response to all the weirdness that happens in the house. You know, she's playful towards it and enjoying the strange events that are occurring, and so it kind of lulls you into this comfort that is completely destroyed once Carol Ann is sucked into this other dimension. It's just it's truly terrifying.
You know, I'm spacing on the name of a very popular film. The other really scary one with the girl in bed and the priest and
The Exorcist.
Exorcist. This came out after The Exorcist, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And this
was
an attempt, if I remember right, from my upbringing, to capitalize on that kind of really scary film that had everyone in the country talking. Am I recalling that?
I think that's true because it's because it's located in the family, and all drama really is located in the family. And so how do we make something that's a genre film more than genre? Well, one thing you can do is try to put it into a familial situation so that you've got those things that we associate with drama and reality and relatability. And, you know, this was the at this point in American history, the cities were losing their population to the suburbs. The suburban boom was happening. So where do we set this? A huge suburban development, getting ready to move into phase three if they can just move all of the bodies and headstones from the graveyard so that they can have room to build more suburban houses. So there's an interesting metaphor at work there, too.
Did this thing scare you when you were a kid?
You bet. Nightmare in broad daylight. You know, that I biked up and down my street with my neighbor buddies as a kid. And I mean, the little homey touches in the movie are what sell it, like the construction worker who reaches in to sample the sauce on the stove, you know, through the window. And you know, she kind of, the wife shoos him away. Just these little touches of very human, normal interaction. It doesn't feel like it's happening because it's in a script. Mm-hmm. That's what I like about it. And Mitch is right. If you want to do something scary, you menace kids. And you don't do it in an exploitative way. And that's what the movie walks. It walks this great line because Carol Ann is this adorable, you know, flaxen-haired little pixie. And, you know, come on, man. They're here. How long? I mean, how many times did you hear that in starting in 1982 in a little weird sing-songy voice? It's a great movie.
What's the clip we have here from Poltergeist, Mitch?
This is a briefing that they're receiving from a diminutive psychic played by Zelda Rubinstein, who is explaining to them how dangerous the situation is ahead of them.
Inside the spectral light is salvation. A window to the next plane. They must pass through this membrane. The friends are waiting to guide them to new destinies. Carol Ann must help them cross over, and she will only hear her mother's voice. No. Hold on to yourselves. There's one more thing. A terrible presence is in there with her. So much rage, so much betrayal. I've never sensed anything like it. I don't know what hovers over this house, but it was strong enough to punch a hole into this world and take your daughter away from you. It keeps Carol Ann very close to it and away from the spectral light. It lies to her. It says things only a child can understand. It has been using her to restrain the others. To her, it simply is another child. To us, he is the beast.
Well, that's kind of scary.
No kidding.
That sort of works.
Great. Goosebumps.
Yow. Holy moly. Yeah.
Pretty great.
This film, Poltergeist, had a big imprint from Steven Spielberg. What's the last thing he's done has he kept it up? Because he was, as you point out, he was bringing these things out like gumdrops back in the day.
Don't look for him to do stuff like he did in the 80s and 90s. Is he still arguably one of the best technical filmmakers on the planet? Yes. I don't love his choice of material lately. I didn't love Bridge of Spies. The BFG didn't move me a lot. I think Minority Report is one of the most extraordinary science fiction movies in recent memory. I think Minority Report is entirely amazing. I thought World of Worlds was fine. I didn't love it, but don't look for this kind of stuff anymore. I don't think that Close Encounters is going to be made by a 70-year-old man. It's going to be made by a guy who's, you know, 25 and full of wonder and loves all the tools in front of him.
But no question, he's one of the three best living directors on the planet right now. Is there any question about that?
Yeah, there are probably some who would dispute it. I think technically, I think he's astounding. I mean, if you look at, you know, but if you break down certain shots like in Raiders of the Lost Ark, things that aren't flashy or showy, just how he lights, how he moves, how he blocks, how he shoots, it's just, wow. It's amazing. He knows how to tell a story. But I just wish he'd told better ones lately.
Okay. Let's do one more before a break here, Aaron. Let's go to Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. We've already talked about this being perhaps the best of the Star Trek films, but The floor is yours.
Yeah, no, I love Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan. And it's so interesting because, you know, Star Trek, the motion picture, which had a bigger budget, was released in 1979, and it looks like a 70s movie. They're wearing jammies in it. I don't know. It just doesn't have the crisp, clear focus that Star Trek II, the Wrath of Khan has. And, you know, Mitch and I kind of talked about this a little bit before, but before we went on the air, but it's so interesting how you can watch Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan without knowing anything about the Star Trek universe. You don't have to have seen any photographs from it, nothing. You can start with Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and you will know everything. And it's not explicitly told to you. There are no long sequences of tired exposition where they're telling us, you know, this is Captain Kirk and this is Spock and this is why you should love them. They simply exist in this universe and you immediately love them. And something that I think is really interesting and really powerful about Star Trek in general, especially the original Star Trek cast, is this idea of male friendship. You just don't see enough of this authentic, true, loving friendship that has its conflicts and has its complexities. And we see that certainly at the end of Star Trek II, and, you know, the sort of loss of that. But I mean, there is an authentic kinship and love between the three main characters, Dr. McCoy, Kirk, and Spock. I mean, and we just don't see enough of that in films anymore. There's usually like a hierarchy, or there's, you know, these sort of tropes, the goofy guy and the guy that, you know, he's the ladies' man and all. And you know, Star Trek is kind of using a little bit of those tropes, but their love for each other is far more complex than that. And I think that's just such an affirming message.
Were those guys buddies off screen?
I believe so. I think
they were together so long.
When Shatner's ego allowed it.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, is that right?
He had an ego that Evel Knievel couldn't jump. Yeah,
is that right?
It was monumental. Yeah, but true. I think they really did have a truly friendship and certainly a mutual respect in spite of that. But yeah, he was the kind of guy who would you know, say that, you know, aren't you giving these guys too many lines? And, you know, isn't Captain Kirk our focus here? That's just how he is.
Yeah.
And it's fine because that was off camera. On camera, they made magic. They made something immortal. So,
mm-hmm. And it's interesting, too. There's a little bit of Star Trek lore in the way that Leonard Nimoy and William Shatner did scenes together. William Shatner was always great in the first takes. So he was fantastic on point in the first takes. Or actually, no, I apologize. I think that Leonard Nimoy was really fantastic in those first takes. And it took William Shatner longer. So he had to really get focused and get into the part. And it's interesting to me, you know, somehow they would kind of get together in the middle and they would be perfect together. But you know.
What's the clip we have here from Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan?
So I chose this clip mostly because, you know, of the beautiful friendship between the three men. So this is after they've just watched the video about Project Genesis. And so it's given them an idea of what this weapon/scientific breakthrough can do. And they, Dr. McCoy, Spock and Captain Kirk are having a discussion about the video.
It literally is Genesis.
Power creation.
Have they proceeded with their experiments?
Well, the tape was made about a year ago, so I can only assume they've reached stage two by now.
But dear Lord, do you think we're intelligent enough to suppose? What if this thing we use where life already exists?
It would destroy such life in favor of its new matrix.
Its new matrix? Do you have any idea what you're saying?
I was not attempting to evaluate its moral implications, Doctor. As a matter of cosmic history, it has always been easier to destroy than to create.
Not anymore. Now we can do both at the same time. According to myth, the Earth was created in 6 days. Now watch out. Here comes Genesis. We'll do it for you in 6 minutes.
Really, Dr. McCoy? You must learn to govern your passions. They will be your undoing.
Okay, that's from Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Spock, the King of Slams, putting down bones pretty hard at the end there, huh?
Yeah. There you go. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll continue our tour of movies of 1982, which launched the summer blockbuster season. We'll get to Rocky III, Conan the Barbarian, Grease 2, and Airplane 2. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. Back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we found out what a history vending machine looks like and why they're popping up in River Market. We also learned about Amelia Earhart's feminist legacy. You can find those conversations at kcur.org. Monday on the show, how opioid abuse is affecting Johnson County. Also, why do sports matter so much to Kansas Cityans? We look for an explanation next time on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, this hour we're reviewing the big films of 1982 that launched the summer blockbuster season. Mitch Bryan is here, Jason Heck, and Aaron Hammerbeck. And what was that music we were just listening to?
Porky's. That was not from Porky's.
That was a guess on my part.
Conan the Barbarian.
Conan the Barbarian. Okay. Let's go to a phone call here. 816-235-2888. Dennis from Waldo. Good morning.
Well, Victor Victoria.
From a 1982. Yeah.
I saw it in the same complex or something like that, you know, down at the Plaza Theater. But at any rate, and I can't remember where I saw it, but anyway, I saw it three times, and every time I saw it, it was a huge crowd. So I remember that movie's being of that era too. But along with Poltergeist, and I tell you, I'm listening to this on earbuds, you know, coming to work, and I was like wrung out listening to.
That's pretty great.
Zelda Rubinstein, you know, doing the thing from Poltergeist. That was just
incredible, wasn't
later,
it? Yeah.
Yeah. What comes later is just what she. Oh, Jesus.
Victor Victoria. That was what Julie Andrews. Mm-hmm.
And Blake Edwards.
And the lesson in that movie is. As James Garner, he was like 52, I think, and he owns the movie after, you know, he gets introduced into it. Along with, well, and Leslie Ann Warren, she's incredible in it too. She got nominated for an Oscar. They were all nominated for Oscars. He was nominated for Best Picture. He was nominated for Screenplay. It won music. Henry Mancini won the Oscar for the music.
Yeah.
But anyway,
I'm glad you called, Dennis. Good memories. Thanks very much. All right. Yeah. Let's run down. What were the top three, four, five top grossing films of 1982?
It's pretty fascinating, actually, because the cross section is fascinating. So number one, Slam Dunk E.T. with $359 million. Number two, any guesses? Got a guess?
Yeah.
With a little bit less than half that, it's Tootsie.
Tootsie. No kidding.
And here's the kicker. Number three, An Officer and a Gentleman.
Wow.
So a lot of guys dragged to that movie on date night.
That's Richard Gere and Deborah Winger,
uh-huh.
Right? Mm-hmm.
And Lou Gossett. Number four, Rocky III. And number five, I don't want to bring it in here because of what it unleashed, but Porky's was number five. So, and then you got Star Trek II, 48 Hours, Poltergeist, Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, and Annie at number 10. So this is an amazing cross-section because right now, if you were to look at the top five, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be genre stuff. It's going to be superheroes and robots and franchises. So these are all with the, well, actually, Rocky III and Star Trek II are sequels, but they're original material back then. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of great.
Year for musicals.
And a big year for musicals.
Victor Victoria was one of them. But mm-hmm. Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. And
great musicals. You've got Gandhi, First Blood.
Yeah. Well.
Are they making as many movies today as they did back in 82?
They are not.
No, because when a movie costs $500 million to get it made and marketed all over the world, these movies weren't made for the Chinese market. But movies now are made for China. You know, there's a reason Pacific Rim 2 is coming out. It didn't make that much money here, but in China, that movie about giant robots made $100 plus million, and that guaranteed a sequel. So, you know, Best Little Whorehouse was not made for the Chinese market.
Okay. Again, we're talking blockbusters and summer blockbusters in the summer of 1982. Jason, let's move on to a film for you here, Rocky III, which ranked, you said...
Rocky III was number four.
Four,
and
yeah.
it is where the formula really gets perfected. So the Rocky movies, you know, we start with one. Everybody thinks he won, but he didn't. He just went the distance, and he and Creed lock up, and they say there ain't going to be no rematch at the end. Mm-hmm. Well, box office That's said right. otherwise. Rocky II, he finally pulls it off. And Rocky III is just... It's amazing. Stallone writes and directs it. So, you know, who knows Rocky better than the guy who created him?
Mm-hmm.
And it's Rocky losing touch with his roots. You know, it was Adrian in the pet shop and Rocky on the ice rink and all this other stuff. And he wins. He takes this huge beating against Apollo and he moves his family into a mansion and he goes soft. And Mick, played by Burgess Meredith, who trained him, Mighty Mick from Mighty Mick's Gym, basically sees his job now to protect Rocky. So he sets him up for title defenses that are kind of punchy losers. They're mm-hmm. they're just a bunch of palookas, and Rocky just demolishes them all very easily. But we cut in this fantastic montage, which I want to talk more about, to James Clubber Lang, played by Mr. T. And he is a bit of a stereotype. He is this sort of black ghetto warrior anti-hero who kind of came to dominate sports films in the 1990s, but this is our first look at him, and he is terrifying. He is incredibly strong, and what he has that Rocky no longer does is he's got the Eye of the Tiger, which was part of the package of Rocky III. Survivor comes out with this song, Eye of the Tiger, which is played in this tremendous montage. And it sits for 6 weeks at number one. It wins an Oscar. Survivor, God bless him, win a Grammy. So that was kind of, and it was because Queen said Sly couldn't use Another One Bites the Dust. That's the song he did want. And it is played to great effect in this absolutely smashing time-passing montage. And the Rocky movies always do great montages. They always do. But it's usually a training montage. It's Rock having to master a skill, catching a chicken or something like that, right?
Yeah.
But this one is a time-passing one, and it basically shows Rocky move the family into a mansion, endorsement deals. And there's a little bit of self-critique here because Sly shows, you know, Rocky on The Muppet Show or meeting President Reagan. That's actually Stallone on The Muppet Show and meeting President Reagan. So there's a little bit of that. But we cut to this incredibly Spartan regime of Clubber Lang doing push-ups, and, you know, in this very, you know, small apartment or running on the south side of Chicago at 5 a.m. and Rocky on his motorcycle and in his Lamborghini and giving Adrian a fur. And what's great, the best part, is Clubber goes to see Rocky's matches and the contempt that he sees Rock when Rocky knocks out these just total wannabes, the contempt from Clubber is just stunning because he knows that Rocky is not at his own level. And so what we have is, of course, Rocky's going to lose the first fight. He's going to win the second. This is not a spoiler, folks. It's a Rocky movie. But he also suffers a huge loss. He suffers a huge loss. Mickey, his trainer, has a heart attack and dies before the first fight. And Rocky's completely off his game. Clubber beats him like a rented mule. It's a fiasco.
I was afraid for Rocky.
It's
Clubber
awful.
Clubber Lang is so scary.
Yeah, I was
and
too.
The
I remember
beating
that.
That he takes is unbelievable.
It's terrifying. And that's what Rocky's great at, right? He's a brawler. He takes punches. So then Apollo Creed, whom he defeated, said, man, you lost it. You lost the Eye of the Tiger. So we're going to go to L.A. to my old gym, Tough Gym, and I'm going to teach you speed and finesse, which you don't have and which Clubber doesn't have, and that's what's going to help you, and you're going to owe me one favor when this is over. But it's great. It's Stallone knows how to direct. He, you know, no one's going to confuse him with Martin Scorsese, but in terms of telling a very coherent story, he knows what to do, and his editors are tremendous. And like I said, this montage is phenomenal. It is not a guilty pleasure. It's just a pleasure. It's great.
And Bill Butler's cinematography is awesome because it's really kind of rough and there's a little smoke here and there. And Stallone leans into what's going to become the 80s aesthetic in certain places, but it's mostly just kind of dark and grimy and
That's
real.
Great.
It's really
What's the
cool.
clip we have here?
Well, this is great. This is what I call Mickey as the demotivator. When Rocky has been insulted and had his manhood challenged by Clubber and says, you want it, we're going to meet. And Mickey says, no. And Rocky's going to find out why.
So why are you doing this?
Because you can't win, Rock. This guy will kill you to death inside of 3 rounds.
You're crazy.
What else is new?
He's just another fighter.
No, he ain't just another fighter. This guy is a wrecking machine, and he's hungry. Hell, you ain't been hungry since you won that belt.
Oh, what are you talking about? I've had 10 title defenses.
That was easy.
What do you mean easy?
They was handpicked.
Setups?
Nah, they weren't setups. They was good fighters, but they wasn't killers like this guy. He'll knock you into tomorrow, Rock.
God, that's good stuff.
It's colorful, Burgess, but it's also apt.
Yeah, that's Rocky III, Jason Heck talking about it. Okay, we're reviewing the best films of the summer of 1982 here. Mitch Bryan, let's move on to Conan the Barbarian and One Arnold.
One Arnold, who is fantastic in this movie. This is the movie that really pushed him big into the mainstream. It was enough of the kind of bodybuilder kind of role that you'd expect to see him in, but what he's surrounded by are extraordinary supporting artists and craftsmen and technicians and the great John Milius co-writing and directing this film. And it's not a guilty pleasure for me. I will defend this movie, you know, against all comers, because it is this beautiful operatic film, one of the best scores ever written for any movie ever by Basil Apollodorus. It is an homage to Japanese cinema. It's an homage to the Western in a way. It's all kind of layered with this beautiful poetic dialogue that John Milius writes, this kind of verbose but poetic macho stuff that's really fantastic.
You're changing my whole image of this film.
It is just an extraordinary movie. And Arnold Schwarzenegger plays Conan, whose parents are murdered by Thulsa Doom, played by James Earl Jones. And after being enslaved and put through gladiator school, he finally escapes and sets out to find the man who murdered his family. And so it's a revenge movie. It's also there are echoes of Apocalypse Now and Heart of Darkness, because Thulsa Doom has this cult of people around him. So in a way, he's like Mr. Kurtz. Mm-hmm. And Conan is like Willard, headed up the river to find him and kill him. The fight scenes are extraordinary. Most of the special effects are physical effects. There's some, you know, there's a little bit of stuff from ILM of lightning and storms, but mostly the giant snake that he fights is a mechanical Carlo Rambaldi built snake that's fairly convincing, certainly more convincing than the Python in Moonraker.
Oh, really? Dump on Moonraker.
We're going to go there. Yeah.
But yeah, it's just an extraordinary movie. It had been in development before it got to Dino De Laurentiis by Ed Pressman, who had hired Oliver Stone to write a screenplay, and Oliver Stone was doing copious amounts of drugs, and he wrote this completely insane, super expensive script that probably could never have been filmed. They needed more money. They went to De Laurentiis, who had a relationship with Schwarzenegger and Milius. Milius came in and rewrote the script and then directed the picture, and he made a movie that made over $100 million. Not quite a blockbuster, but it had an R rating, so probably more for the nudity than the violence, because the violence is actually pretty tame and pretty well choreographed. But definitely, again, as the evolution of the blockbuster happens, the next Conan movie is going to be family friendly and PG-13. So
and crap.
So this, accept no substitutes. This is the one to check out.
Can Arnold Schwarzenegger act?
Oh yeah, he can act.
Mm-hmm.
He had a dialogue coach. He had to learn to speak English more clearly. But yeah, I think I've always found him to be a very honest actor. I've always found him to you know, he's Arnold Schwarzenegger. He's larger than life. He's never going to be able to play your next door neighbor.
I think your impression after this movie is, can he act? I don't know. Can he be a screen presence? Absolutely. He radiates charisma like our sun radiates heat and light. He's phenomenal. Truly. Nice. I mean, you look at some people and you're like, that's a movie star. Arnold Schwarzenegger, whether or not you like his accent or not, is a movie star. In this movie, he's a movie star front and center. He's amazing.
What's the clip we have here from Conan the Barbarian?
So this is from early on in the movie when Conan's father is giving his son a sword and telling him about the Riddle of Steel. And I want to point out that in Oliver Stone's original script, here are the lines. It won't take you long to find out. You can't trust anybody in this world, Conan, man, woman, or beast, but this you can trust. So John Milius takes that idea and builds this unbelievably poetic soliloquy out of it that we will now hear.
Fire and wind come from the sky, from the gods of the sky. But Crum is your god. Crum, and he lives in the earth. Once giants lived in the earth, Conan. And in the darkness of chaos, they fooled Crum. and they took from him the enigma of steel. Crom was angered, and the earth shook. And fire and wind struck down these giants, and they threw their bodies into the waters. But in their rage, the gods forgot the secret of steel and left it on the battlefield. And we who found it are just men. Not gods, not giants, just men. And the secret of steel has always carried with it a mystery. You must learn its riddle, Conan. You must learn its discipline. For no one, no one in this world can you trust. Not men, not women, not beasts. This you can trust.
Well, the poetry you're talking about comes through pretty clearly.
Yeah, pretty cool,
isn't it? Yeah, very nice. Okay. Well, Aaron Hammerbeck, let's come back to you here and talk about a film, Grease 2.
Ambitious choice.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you know, Grease 2 definitely is a guilty pleasure. I can't say that that's a pleasure without a certain amount of guilt. Actually, I like Grease 2 more than Grease, which will probably affect all of my credibility from here on out talking about films.
Good luck buying a house from now on.
I know, exactly. I shouldn't like it, right? It was a film that didn't have a completed script when they started filming it. The filmmaker, it's directed by and choreographed by Patricia Birch. It's her first and only full-length movie, but she choreographed the first Grease film. It stars Maxwell Caulfield, Adrian Zmed, and Michelle Pfeiffer in her first major role.
No Travolta.
Actually,
no Olivia.
Zmed.
No, Olivia Newton-John and John Travolta actually came in and they talked about being in this film, but they ended up not being a part of it. However, they do bring back several of the characters and actors that performing their original roles. This was actually Eve Arden's last film, tragically. She played the principal, and Sid Caesar comes back as Coach Calhoun. Dodie Goodman comes back as Blanche, and Dee Dee Cohen comes back as Frenchie. And if you're familiar with this film, you may have noticed that Frenchie mysteriously disappears halfway through the film, and that it goes back to the fact that they didn't have the script completed when they were filming it. And she was told halfway through that they didn't want to include her character any longer. However, in the last cut, they decided to bring her back, but they have this very limited amount of footage of her. So that's why there's this strange presence of Frenchie and then disappearance of Frenchie.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, we've kind of been talking about like sort of these sincere performances in these films. And honestly, I think that that's why I really love Grease 2. They are very sincere performances, with the exception of maybe Maxwell Caulfield, who seems to be kind of apathetic at times, but part of that might have come from the fact that he did not get along well with Michelle Pfeiffer. They had pretty epic fights on sets.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
Just did not like each other one bit. But you know, the music is kind of odd, because at times they're trying to be, 1960s music. It takes place in 1961, 2 years after the original Grease. And so some of it's trying to sound like 60s doo-wop, you know, kind of borrowing from some of those motifs, like in the song Reproduction. But a lot of it sounds very 1980s. Michelle Pfeiffer sings this song called Cool Rider, and it's very 80s pop. In fact, Pat Benatar and Debbie Harry were asked to play the part of Stephanie.
Oh, wow.
And they chose not to. Debbie Harry didn't want to do it because she felt she was too old, but most of these people were in their 20s and 30s anyway. So,
what's the clip we have here?
This is a clip that I chose because I really kind of love this song. It sounds a little Broadway, but it's performed by Maureen Teefy, who she plays Sharon, and Peter Fraschetti, who plays DiMucci. And basically, DiMucci convinces Sharon to come into this bomb shelter where this romantic musical interlude occurs.
What's that?
get started.
America is calling. Let's care enough to give our very best.
What started? What's happening, Lewis?
The Russians are attacking. Get down!
For if we give our very best, I know that we will more than pass the test.
What are you doing, Lewis? Get off of me!
You think about it. What if you and me was to die right here tonight without ever doing it?
It? Oh, my God! Let me out of here, Lewis!
You crazy? They're dropping bombs out there!
Yeah, let's do it for our country. The red, white, and the blue. It's Uncle Sam who's asking, so your mother will approve. Tomorrow I'll be fighting, and I'll win this war for you. Let's do it for our country. Our country wants us to.
That's from Grease 2 as we review some of the best films of 1982 and the launch of the summer blockbuster season. Well, we've done Star Trek 2, we've done Grease 2, and let's wrap it up with Jason Heck taking us out with Airplane 2.
In a summer of
Airplane 2?
Why not Airplane 2?
Okay. Yeah.
In a summer of sequels, you know, Friday the 13th Part 3 in 3D was the first movie to knock E.T. out of the number one spot. People love sequels. Airplane 2. So the first one makes $130 million on a $3.5 million budget. It's insane. It's printing money. Why can't we do that again? Well, because Zucker, Abrahams, and Zucker, the writer creators of Airplane, are not on board. So they bring in a guy named Ken Finkelman, who was the writer of Grease 2, who is a Canadian humorist. And they basically recreate Airplane, but in space. It's on a space shuttle called the Mayflower 1. And we have most of our core cast returning. We have Ted Stryker. We have Elaine, his stewardess girlfriend. We have Captain Over, our benevolent pederast on the flight deck. We have Lloyd Bridges as Steve McCroskey, the control on the ground. And then we have this amazing supporting cast, no fooling. So you have 80s TV superstars Frank Ashmore, James Noble. You have TV superstars of the 60s, Kent McCord, Chad Everett. You have Sonny Bono. You have William Shatner, Raymond Burr, John Vernon, Pat Sajak as the Buffalo Anchorman, Art Fleming as Art Fleming, and Hervé Villechaize as the Little Breather. So what I'm saying
And George Wendt.
And George Wendt, that's true.
Is that right?
So it's a phenomenal supporting cast. The movie takes Airplane's scatological approach to humor. It's double entendres, it's puns, it's visual gags. It's thrown at you at 10 a minute. Now, an Airplane, probably about 40% stuck, so you're laughing four times a minute, pretty much uproariously. And this, it's more like two a minute. Now, if Airplane had never existed, this movie would seem a lot funnier. But here's the thing. It's still pretty funny. I mean, it really, for a guy who is not, you know, in that pantheon of great humorists like the Zuckers used to be, it's actually a pretty funny movie. And we have Sonny Bono as my favorite. He's a mad bomber right out of Airport, where he's played by Van
Heflin.
Heflin. I almost said Van Johnson. Van Heflin in Airport, and he's got his luggage has all these travel stickers from places like Dresden and Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And it's just really great. And Shatner is phenomenal as Buck Murdoch.
What's the clip we have here?
Well, our clip is Ted Stryker has deduced that Sonny Bono is the bomber, and he wants Mary the stewardess to try and get people away from him so he can make his move.
From Airplane 2.
Mary?
Yes?
Which passenger is Joe Salucci?
16C, why?
He's carrying a bomb.
A bomb?
No, not a a bomb. Now, as discreetly as possible, I want you to move the passengers into the lounge.
We don't have a lounge.
That's not important right now. What you've got to do is get those people away from that bomb.
Well, what should I say?
Anything. Just don't let Salucci think that we're on to him.
I'll do my best. Attention, ladies and gentlemen, please.
Would everybody move to the lounge who is not carrying a bomb?
I love it. It is a guilty pleasure. It's not a great movie, but I laugh a lot when I watch it.
How did this film pull at the box office?
Not great. On a budget of 15, it pulled in about 28. So it broke even, but it was not the runaway hit that Airplane was. And a little bit of trivia, I saw this in the theater in Parsons, Kansas, with my cousins Charlie and Carrie Sue. And I remember laughing a lot as a kid. So.
Well, I'm just amazed at how many films were made that year compared to what we're seeing these days. I mean, the comparison is just it's amazing to me, man.
The audience is different today. You know, they've got to recoup all that gigantic amounts of cash, and they've got to do it by striking the largest possible audience, old, young, male, female. So go back to 1982. Go to Wikipedia, pick a date. Look at that date. Look at all the movies that came out, and go watch something from the old days.
A lot of these are on Netflix. A lot of these are on Amazon streaming. Go to your neighborhood video store. There aren't any.
Public libraries, though.
Go to your public library.
Well, this has been a great reunion of our video gurus, Jason Heck, Mitch Bryan, and Aaron Hammerbeck. Thank you all for coming in and sharing your great insights into all these good movies. Appreciate it very much.
Missed you, City Slicker.
Oh, I miss you, too. Yeah, welcome back. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date, and you can follow me at Steve Kraske. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On Monday's show, we find out how opioid abuse is affecting Johnson County, and we'll try to figure out why sports fandom is so darn important to Kansas City. The great Bobby Watson composed our theme music. We had help this week from Linda Scherer, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Marlia Campbell. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.